It really comes down to, should grazing be uniform and moderate, or should it be highly variable and very patchy? And that was sort of the fundamental question, of which then the question was, well, how do you get those two if you're trying to manage, grazing animals?
Many regenerative ranchers use mob grazing, where dense herds of livestock graze a place only for a very brief time before moving on, as a way to increase grass production and soil health. Graziers from across the globe have had success with this approach, but hey, what about the wild things? Is it always true that what's good for the herd is good for the bird? This episode of Voices from the Field is the first part of a conversation between Dr. Sam Fuhlendorf of Oklahoma State University and NCAT grazing specialist Linda Poole. They talk about using grazing to bolster, rather than unintentionally harm, desirable wildlife on our farms and ranches. Be sure to come back for the next episode when they'll talk about how to apply the principles of these strategies on smaller operations. Let's listen.
Hi, this is Linda Poole with NCAT's ATRA and Soil for Water programs. And our guest today is Dr. Sam Fuhlendorf of Oklahoma State University. And our topic is going to be livestock grazing with wildlife in mind. And this is important to us at NCAT, the folks who consult with you all on grazing, because the choices that we make about managing our livestock have impacts on the wildlife that share our land, on our neighbors, on our downstream water users. It's a community. We affect a lot of different things. And Dr. Fuhlendorf has spent a lot of time looking into variable effects of different types of grazing on climate, on wildlife, and on the livestock themselves. And so this is our chance to talk with Sam about these topics in a way that I hope we can understand better about all the impacts of the grazing decisions that we make. So welcome to the podcast, Sam. And could we begin with a brief sketch of your background and your expertise on this topic?
Great. Thank you, Linda. I'm honored to be here. And I think this is an important topic, but I may be biased. But I was raised in Texas and from a somewhat of an ag background. That my father worked for the government, but we lived in a community that had a lot of ag, and I went to school in West Texas, majoring in agriculture, and worked on a lot of ranches there. And I went to Angelo State University, and then I went to the to Texas A&M for my master's and my PhD, and I worked largely, some of you may know, the Sonora Experiment Station. With Fred Smines and Butch Taylor were my mentors. And we looked at, my PhD was looking at, in 1948, Leo Merrill set up some plots monitoring grass under different grazing strategies. And I sort of built on that data and collected some more. And that's what I did my PhD on. It's interesting when I think back about it, because at the time, a lot of the discussion was, well, there's really nothing new for us to learn about grazing, which I thought was, in looking back, that seems odd, because it seems like there's been a lot to learn about it. With that in mind, when I got to OSU, the biggest need, it seemed to me at the time, was that there was a lot of interest in figuring out how to manage grazing for conservation of wildlife. And it started with things like prairie chickens and grassland birds, but it's kind of grown to a lot of different things since then. So that gave me a place to take my grazing management knowledge and sort of apply it in more of a ecological context for interest in wildlife. And initially I was really interested in grassland birds and prairie chickens, as I mentioned. And I remember when I first got into it, I had always been interested in wildlife, but I didn't study it a lot when I was in school. And I remember being challenged by an organization to determine how to manage grazing for grassland birds. And as I dove into the literature, one of the things that I found was that some of the birds had requirements that were that would suggest, say, short vegetation, and some of the birds had requirements that suggested long. And I thought, oh my, that sounds challenging or even impossible. And then I start, but I'd always been thinking about this heterogeneous landscape context. And so it sort of played right into that. And along the same lines, working with some other overlapping endangered species, and one would require heavy grazing and one would require little or no grazing. And the realization, well, there's no real way to write a prescription that would for one condition of a grassland that would feed both species. And so I got really interested in that. And at the same time, I was also trying to understand just how do grazing animals behave and where will they graze if you allow them to graze wherever they want to graze. And so collectively, I sort of, I guess, poof, next thing you know, I have a career. And it's been a lot of fun, but it is interesting because in some ways it's led me down a path that I don't know that I would have ever gotten down if I hadn't started thinking about wildlife and grazing.
You want to say more about that path?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I'm a typical sort of hard-headed German, and early on, just as an example, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had some money to cost share for prairie chickens, and they went around asking people what they should do, and I was on the list, and they came to me, and I sort of described that they probably need this heterogeneity, this patchiness, and they didn't listen to me, and, you know, that I don't know that I blame them for that, because I really didn't know that much then, and I didn't have a lot of data. And they imposed their own sort of management, and which is mostly gone now. But as a result of that, I decided that I would start my own study to sort of show how what I was saying might be right, or ask the question, is it right? And then in the process, I sort of realized that it was kind of the opposite in some ways of what they were promoting for the chicken through the cost share. So I, that got my attention because of just the idea of, well, are we doing things backwards? And it really comes down to, should grazing be uniform and moderate, or should it be highly variable and very patchy? Mm-hmm. And that was sort of the fundamental question, of which then the question was, well, how do you get those two if you're trying to manage, you know, grazing animals? And so that sort of initiated a focus. Some of those first studies started in the late 90s. So, and they're still going, actually. So, and anybody's welcome to call me and come look at them if you're interested.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting to me about this is I was doing my master's thesis in the Columbia Basin of Washington State in the 80s, the late 80s. And I worked on loggerhead shrikes and habitat selection, and ignorant of the type of work that you were doing in other places and having grown up on a ranch. Of course, I'm always thinking about How does our grazing affect things? And this is an ungrazed by domestic herbivores landscape that I was in. But, you know, I was trying to think about how do I characterize the habitat that these birds need? And loggerhead shrikes are very like sage grouse, and it sounds like maybe prairie chickens too, in that what they need is a mosaic. For nesting, what shrikes need is they want real dense kind of, I call them old growth shrubs. So greasewood or sagebrush, big wolfy, great big things. And they need quite a few of them because they build phaco nests to, you know, fool the predators, you know, find the nest that has the chicks in it. You ravens, you know, so they That's wanted awesome. That. Pardon me.
That's awesome. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And they're foraging. They wanted bare ground or desert pavement with rocks because they're after lizards and they're after insects. Big juicy insects that they can then impale on the on the barbed wire fence in their very gruesome butcher bird way of doing things. And sure. And what they needed was this mosaic within a given area that had these big dense shrubs. They wanted some grass. They wanted some bare ground where the insects were both abundant and vulnerable to being swooped upon. And I was thinking, man, this would be hard to do.
Right.
If you had to do it like with a farming type of a lens, or if you had a small property, you know, how could you make money with a small property if you're trying to put this together? So I'm kind of excited about, we were doing some of the same stuff at the same time without understanding that this was moving forward. And I think one thing that might help our listeners, Sam, is can you explain what you mean by heterogeneity, both on a horizontal axis and on vertical through layering? Can you give us kind of a visual picture of what a heterogeneous landscape would look like?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you're right, that is important. So by heterogeneity, I mean, arguably, it's just variability, although it includes a little bit more when you actually think about it from a conservation standpoint. So generally speaking, I'm talking about, the easiest way to think about it is over space, is parts of the landscape that are very different from other parts and largely due to disturbance, grazing and fire and or fire. And so it can be variability in the height of the vegetation. For example, some plant communities that are taller than others, but it also can be variable in terms of the total amount of biomass and the density and all of that together. And I think what you described with the shrikes is a perfect example of what we've seen as well, is that, you know, if you go out and you think, well, I have this, I mean, the simplest landscape, if you just think of a prairie and it's got, you know, grass that's 12 inches tall, if it's moderately grazed, and it's, you know, twice that if it's not grazed, and it's real short if it's grazed heavily. What we've traditionally done is we've tried to promote it all to be the 12 inches across the entire landscape. Nothing's too heavily grazed and nothing's ungrazed. And that's what I tend to call management to the middle. And I was trained in range, and I can tell you that I was sort of fully indoctrinated that that's what's supposed to make me happy. And, you know, so if you come over a hill and you see this uniform looking grassland that's been well managed, but it's been grazed and there's nothing too heavily grazed, that's supposed to be what makes you happy. And in reality, it was for a while until I learned that that's not perfect for everything that we might want. So in that sense, you can think from a management standpoint, I like to think of it as that we all have sort of a visual target of what we think a place ought to look like. And, you know, and in theory, we try to make it look that way. Well, I think some of what I was taught was bad is actually what we need when we start talking about managing for biodiversity or wildlife or those sorts of things. Now, that doesn't mean it has to always be bad. And that doesn't mean you want to all of a sudden make a bunch of erosion and everything else. But it is sort of this recognition that what we visually think is perfect is not perfect for everything.
Yeah, I got a big lesson in that years ago. An agroecologist from Australia visited over here in Montana, where I'm at. And we were looking at the patterning of grazing and talking about wildlife. And she shared with me what happened in Australia. And I don't know how widespread this was, or if it was just a particular, you know, station or, you know, I don't know how ubiquitous it was, but they started to manage for what we for a long time have called good grazing management, where you reduce the selectivity of the grazing and take half, leave half. And our picture was that was the way to boost livestock productivity and plant health and biomass. And so they did that for a while. And what they started to see is that the kangaroos were wrecking up all the stuff, that good work that they were doing with their cattle and their sheep. And so they got rid of the kangaroos.
Oh, yeah.
Because kangaroos are very patchy grazers.
Sure.
And it wasn't very long after they did that, that they started to see a bunch of weeds, which is, you know, that's a common thing to see when you release grazing pressure from a system. Right. You know, a lot of times weeds will come up. So that was, you know, that wasn't much of a problem. But what the next problem was, is their wildlife communities just vastly started to simplify. And what they started to understand was that this mosaic needed to, if you were going to get rid of your kangaroos, you needed to intentionally overgraze with your cattle to recreate those kangaroo lawns if you wanted to get your wildlife communities back up and going. And to me, that was just like, here we go again. You know, it's another version of, I would have looked at this. And I mean, I did this with the shrikes. I look at bare ground and I think bad. And I look at nice grass and I think good, because I think with my pocketbook and I think with my eyes, ground looks prettier if it's got hair on it, you know, if sure. it's got plants across it.
Sure.
But that's me, and I'm a human, and I am not the wildlife that depend upon this landscape for success. So anyway, it seems like it's something that goes on worldwide, this idea of needing to have some heterogeneity, vertical complexity, and patchiness across a landscape to provide for wildlife. And to me, if that is our context, we know we need to have that. How do we bring into that conversation some of the new things that we're looking at, you know, what we call regenerative grazing now? A lot of people are doing ultra high stock density, you know, moving their livestock every few days or maybe every few hours. And the goal is, at least as I understand it and as I've practiced it myself, is to eliminate that selective grazing. When you come out, you have quite a bit of litter trampled into the ground and it's pretty even, you know, set a stage of non-competition with your desired plants by knocking down your undesirable species at the same time. And so what you get when you come out of it, it looks like you ran a roller crimper across your landscape. So is there some way, if people want to try some of this more intensive regenerative grazing, is there a way to have that not crater your wildlife communities?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And unfortunately, I haven't done as good, you know, I haven't done as good a job as I would like to get at really creative ways of doing that, like you described. So as we got into this, and particularly since I'm in the Southern Great Plains, a big issue that we have in this region is, and it's called even the greatest threat to livestock production in the region, is woody plant encroachment. Mm-hmm. And so to confound the challenge a little more, not only did we have a lot of species of wildlife we wanted to manage for, as well as the livestock, we also had to figure out a way to kill trees. Mm-hmm. So early on, the primary focus we had was using fire to move the animals. And so we set up that sort of study with the intent. My original intent was, well, I'll do this. And then in other cases, we'll come up with some other ways that we can manage this to create this heterogeneity. And unfortunately, I haven't done much of that. We've done a little bit of it, and I've experienced some of it on different people's property. But just to finish the discussion of the fire as well, you know, fire is kind of like grazing. The first thing, if you go to the general public and you say grazing, then there's going to be people that have strong opinions against grazing, and there'll be people that potentially have strong opinions for grazing. And the same thing can happen with fire, and you can have too much of it and you can have too little of it in some environments. And that's the same thing true with grazing. So the interesting thing from the adding fire into it that just really shocked me was that the number one driver of where bison and cattle will graze is the recently burned areas.
Mm-hmm.
and they are on them while they're still smoking. And one of the points that I've made is that we've excluded fire from studies of herbivory for 100 or more years. And in reality, it's like, it, you know, we've excluded the most important variable, because if you allow animals to select, we'll think, you know, you may think water. We did an early study where we actually looked at small 4-acre burn plots that varied in distance from water, thinking that once we got up to a mile away, the animals would no longer go to those and we could document that. Well, they used all of them up even, you know, further than a mile away from water. Mm-hmm. So they've got this strong attraction to burned areas. Now, I don't know, you know, it's not just burned. It's really for short vegetation. And some of it has to do with being in the Southern Great Plains and the fact that forage quality follows a real strange relationship. Basically, the best way to have the highest quality forage is to have zero forage.
Yep.
Or near zero forage.
Yeah, we learned that with prairie dogs.
Yeah, right.
Here in Montana.
Yeah, it's the same sort of discussion.
NCAT's Soil for Water connects you with farmers, ranchers, and land managers who are discovering practical ways to catch and hold more water in their soils. Find their stories of success, practical tips for soil health, and more at soilforwater.org.
And so the problem is, and this is the argument that I've made that's sort of regardless of fire, you know, I like the idea of allowing animals to manage their own stress. And if they need more crude protein, then go get it. And if they need less, they can go over here and get more energy. But if you have all the animals enclosed in one paddock that all the vegetation is identical, then sure, you're getting no selectivity of grazing, but they can't really deal with stress very well either, because the only way you can deal with stress is to move somewhere different and eat something different. So philosophically, that the fire thing got me interested in, well, what if we have a landscape with cows on it and there's six different patches versus a landscape where we think we make everything perfect and it's all the same. Mm-hmm. And I guess I like to argue, my joke about it is, well, if there's six different patches, you're six times less likely to be entirely wrong.
True.
And whereas if it's all the same, you dang well better be right. And so acknowledging that, I still think that I realize that's probably not what most people want to hear, is that acknowledging that we don't know as much as we should know. But I do think that's the case, is that, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty, and knowing exactly what an animal needs every minute of every day is really quite a burden. But allowing animals to select different forages and so forth, and promoting heterogeneity so that they can manage their own stress, seems attractive. But then back to the wildlife response was really the first thing we saw. So when mm-hmm. we started doing this and we started realizing there were species like the shrikes and the prairie chickens, and prairie chickens, basically they lek or do their breeding display on recently burned patches mm-hmm. that are being heavily grazed, that have no vegetation, but they have to nest somewhere fairly close by that has a lot of rank and sometimes 2 or 3 year old ungrazed, unburned grasslands. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how in the world are you going to have those? Well, you know, we can start to, so we set up these studies to make that. And then the idea was, well, maybe we'll do these studies and maybe it will hurt livestock and we'll find some negative things about it too. And if that's the case, and then maybe there'll be cost share programs or something, who knows, but at least we'll know what these species need. And so some of the positive things we experienced with the livestock were pleasant surprises actually down those roads. So the wildlife were pretty consistent. We had things like prairie chickens that have big landscapes and they need heterogeneity across all of them. But then we have species like Henslow sparrows that occur in Oklahoma, and they require little or no grazing or fire for at least 2 years, and some say 3 years. And then simultaneously, we have a lot of birds that require, you know, just hammered prairie.
Mm-hmm.
And so with all of that up, then we can put the livestock, you know, we're currently studying mixed species grazing with cattle and goats. We started with mostly cattle, and we had bison at the Tallgrass Prairie Preserve that we also studied. Mm-hmm. And we also have studied horses and elk as well. But the interesting thing, the other thing that you may be interested in talking about a little bit is the bison. I know when a lot of people talk about high density grazing, it's often justified by the way bison would have grazed historically. Well, I actually I'm one of the few people that have had the great opportunity to study free roaming bison on a landscapes with fire and heterogeneity. Now we've been studying, well, people studied it before I started, but I've been doing it for 25 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And so when people talk about how animals graze, I sometimes wonder how they got the idea that they think they grazed the way they did. And obviously things have changed even now on the places I'm studying, because we don't always have all the predators, and there's extreme climate events that are different and so forth. But the curious thing about it is that, yes, animals do graze in fairly high densities, but they may not get back to that spot for several years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big difference than what most people are talking about with high density grazing. So,
yep. Yeah, well, I think that those are such important observations. And I think about Fred Provenza, Dr. Fred Provenza, emeritus professor at Utah State. And I had him come up when I was managing the Matador Ranch for the Nature Conservancy and look at our grazing. And two of the things that you just said really, really resonate with what Fred told me about our exact management there. So I had a monoculture. I had a crested wheatgrass planted field, and crested wheatgrass, for people who don't know it, is a perennial bunch grass. And in our landscape in northern Montana, it's invasive, and it has a role to play in grazing. It's really good for calving pastures because it's kind of bulletproof at that stage, but the diversity is really low. And so I had been working with various different agencies and people to think about how do I get more diversity into my crested wheatgrass. And what we had decided to do, it actually happened before I got there, was to put a fence around the crested wheatgrass, because that was standard practice in the early 2000s or so. You know, you try to fence like areas into one pasture and manage them for that. So you put all the crested wheatgrass in one pasture, and then you can graze it really hard, knock back the vigor, and then get some, you know, introduce some other seeds. And so I was talking to Fred about it, and he said, well, that's one way you could do it, but it's not the way I would do it. And of course, you'd have Fred Provenza there. How would sure. you do it, Fred? And he said, I would make sure to fence it in with an equal amount of native prairie. Because what you were saying, Sam, about reducing the stress on the livestock by allowing them to choose their diet, what Fred was saying, and what he has a lot of excellent webinars and books and things on that sure. people could dive into, is that when livestock and wildlife have access to diversity of different plants, they can moderate their diets, they can mix and match in a way that, if I put them on straight crested wheatgrass and say, eat this, they are going to satiate very quickly, and they're going to get thin before they really hit that crested wheatgrass, because it's an unbalanced diet, where if I allow them to have greater diet selectivity, they can take it down more. And of course, I did what he said, and I saw exactly what he predicted. So it was like there's an eye opener of the importance of allowing a diverse landscape to be able to help you to manage the problem pieces. You know, another one, as we think about fire in the landscape and how that works. We had a fire on the Matador, and I saw exactly what you did. We had 900 yearling heifers in the pasture. It was a 3,000 acre pasture where they were. And of course, we chased all the heifers out of the fire so they don't get burned up. And the next morning, I look out and all the heifers and a couple hundred pronghorn antelope are right in that fire. And they have black faces, you know, black lipstick all over them because they wanted to get into, there was something about the charcoal, I think. Anyway, they wanted to be in there. And our idea is to homogenize things as ways to increase productivity and manage risk. But really, what I hear you saying is heterogeneity is really a risk management strategy.
It is. And in fact, you know, we actually have some data on this and a couple of different kinds of data. Probably the most relevant to most listeners is a study that Brady Allred, a former student, did that included livestock performance data on pastures that varied from no patches, so we burned the whole pasture or we didn't, to all the way up to 8 patches. So same size, they're all over 1,000 acre pastures. And so we had 8 patches versus 1 patch, and or no patches if you prefer. And what we found was that for the one pastures that had no patches, they were strongly related to rainfall. So basically rainfall was a primary driver of how much gain they would get off of those properties or that land. When we created the patchwork, and it really didn't matter how many patches it was, as long as there were multiple patches that were different, we had no relationship with rainfall and weight gain.
Wow.
So basically it became, when it was dry, we still had slightly less weight gain, but there was no significant relationship. And we actually had more pastures in that treatment. So basically, when everything's perfect, homogeneous management is really good. But if anything goes wrong, then having this heterogeneity across the landscape, those pastures actually perform much better.
Yeah, I read in one of your papers, or maybe I heard it in one of your webinars, what I had written down here, spatial heterogeneity is protection against temporal variability. In the case of drought, we made it through the drought better with heterogeneous management than with homogeneous management. It's kind of like a strategy to drought proof or make your property more drought resilient. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah. So if you've got an area that's accumulating a lot of grass that, and the animals are all congregated on a different area, well, if things get bad enough, those animals can, it's like stockpiling forage, essentially. I mean, it might have been forage that you were going to use for something else or for habitat for something else. But during the drought, it becomes an option that you can actually use that.
Yeah, and that's so important. You know, what we know about the world today is that it's getting, at least the Western U.S., it's getting drier, it's getting hotter. The weather is more chaotic. We're about to have a drought or we're about to have a flood. And one of the things that we spend a lot of time thinking about in NCAT is how to help farmers and ranchers build resilience into their operations. And so what would be your advice on how you might use this idea of heterogeneity or other strategies that you have for, you know, how can we pre-adapt to what's headed down the highway right in our faces with these climate changes?
Well, first of all, let me just say this, that I think the most important thing we can do is, in my dream world, I would be able to convince a lot of people, like probably many that are listening to this podcast, that I'm not selling anything. The only thing I'm really strongly convinced of is that heterogeneity is really important. And what I would really like, people who have a different background than me, mainly people who are managing ranches all over the place, is to come up with some really creative ways of making heterogeneity that I would be incapable of thinking of. And I've seen it happen already, and I've come up with a few ideas probably that I stole from somebody. I just don't remember who it was, so I guess it doesn't matter, right? You know, for example, I was in South Africa, and I was a rancher told me that this was what he was doing, but he uses rotational grazing and doesn't use fire. And I don't remember the details, but he basically described something like a 20 paddock system. And he put all the animals in paddock one, and he kept them in there too long. He let them graze it way down.
Mm-hmm.
He would go to two, and then quickly to three, and then quickly to four. And as soon as one had enough grass back in it again, which was not very much, he would put them back in one.
Yep.
And then he would never get all the way around, because then he would go to two again and three. So you were getting one through five were very heavily grazed. You know, five through 10 were only getting periodic grazing. And then he never got all the way around. And then the next year he would move where one was no longer one, you know, maybe two was. And so it's basically a rotational system geared toward creating heterogeneity, including patches that may not get grazed for a year or two, or paddocks in this case. And I think that's an example of some kind of creativity. There are others. I do encounter people that don't want to build lots of cross fences. And there are things like, you know, having multiple water sources, but fencing some of them off and forcing the animals to graze in one corner, and then leave them up there most of one year and then move them, you know. But I think the big difference from a wildlife standpoint is if we get all the way through all the pastures really quickly, then we're really not creating much heterogeneity. I mean, there may be a little bit between paddock one and paddock 20, but it's all grown this year because it's all been pretty heavily grazed one time through or something. So really what we have to think about is how do we get this gradient of heterogeneity so that we have patches that have accumulated biomass. And this is really particularly important in places where they do have to use fire, because the problem is it forage or is it fuel? In this case, they can burn it because it's accumulated a lot of fuel, and then the animals will congregate on that. And then what gets burned next year is accumulating a lot of fuel.
Yep.
But it's similar from a drought standpoint. So if you have all that and you have some places that have a lot of grass and then it turns dry, then you can go ahead and use that grass as well, which is a little bit of a buffer. And it, you know, that year it may not be good for the wildlife, but you can get back into it again.
Mm-hmm.
There are some other creative ways, you know. On a similar note, one of the things that we're talking about a lot is in Oklahoma, and I've spent a decent amount of time in Montana and lots of other states that are wonderful, and this is pretty common. But in Oklahoma, multi-species grazing is heresy. And so some of what we're trying to get them to recognize is that diversity of the forage base is not only important, but diversity of the herbivore may also be important, because while there's some dietary overlap, it's not perfect. So you can actually have more animals with less grazing pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can get animals, if you have a woody plant problem, then, you know, goats are, they may not cure the problem, but they're certainly more useful at controlling woody plants than cows. So mixing up the species as well. But the idea is to try and think about creating a patchwork that includes really intensively disturbed areas and areas that are largely undisturbed. And I think you can do it with electric fence. The big challenge I have with doing it with, say, electric fence or even permanent fence is one of the things that I've seen in a lot of the studies I've done is that if depending on how you rotate, and with lots of exceptions, a consistent finding is that you can get lower livestock production
right
from rapid rotation. And I think that's mainly a function of you're forcing them to eat things they don't want to eat, which, you know, maybe is still what you want to do, even though it might lower production a little bit. But then also sometimes, you know, the animals are waiting by the fence to move to the next paddock, and that, so they may just consume less. And there's some data that suggests that may be the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of this has to do with really understanding stockmanship and right. reading your animals as well as you read the land. I just listened to a discussion with Graham Hand from Australia about safe to fail experiments and the idea of taking a small area of your farm or ranch to try some of these things and see how they work. And he was also talking about, sometimes we think the problem with livestock performance is the amount of vegetation that we take off or the type of vegetation, you know, it's missing some special ingredient nutrient that they need. And it might just be that we don't have the right epigenetics. It might be that we don't have the right stockmanship. And sometimes we can correct those things and see different outcomes.
We'll end this week's episode right there. Be sure to come back next time for the rest of the conversation. Additional information about this episode and related resources can be found at atra.ncat.org. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Voices from the Field wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your host, Rich Myers. ATRA, Voices from the Field, is produced by the National Center for Appropriate Technology, headquartered in Butte, Montana. It's supported by the USDA Rural Business Cooperative Service as part of NCAT's ATRA Sustainable Agriculture Program. Any opinions, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this recording are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of the USDA or NCAT. We'll catch you again next week, and until then, keep on farming.